Okay. Good morning. So, I was at TASTI 99, that is a graduate student school for, summer school for physics graduate students, and gave four lectures on ADCSC. And Dave Morrison was there, and he asked me to repeat those four lectures into two lectures for mathematical audience. And that's not so easy. So, I'll have to select what to talk. And So what I want to do, I think, is the following. So this might change as the lecture evolves, but I want to give you, my aim, I think, will be to give you, first of all, to give a reasonably rigorous statement about what ADS-CFT correspondence is about, and present you some of the evidences, and in particular, how the correspondence works. So this is a correspondence between two quantum theories, so that means that there has to be an equivalence or isomorphism between the Hilbert spaces of the two theories. And so I want to explain you how this works, or how this is supposed to work. And I'll give you a general idea behind this new correspondence. And I'm not sure what's the interest of the audience to this new conjecture. There hasn't been so much, I think, very deep technical mathematics used in this analysis of this so far, although there are some. And so perhaps it would be very useful if you could give me some feedback on what you want to know. And but maybe today I will give you some. I will spend today, most of my talk today, preparing for what I'm going to talk tomorrow. So. But let me give you some introduction. So this is a statement about the equivalence of the two quantum theories. So one is string theory on ADS, anti-Doppler space. I guess I go too close to the speaker. P plus 2 dimension, and I will tell you what this space is, times some compact space M. And this is supposed to be equivalent to certain conformal field theory without gravity on P plus one dimensional sphere when we are talking about Euclidean space, Euclidean signature space, or R times SP when we are considering Minkowskian signature correspondence, where the time direction is in R. So why this is so interesting for physicists or string theories? And first of all, this gives us a definition of a string theory in some cases. And before this ADS-CFT correspondence came out, well, actually to be precise, before 95, when duality, so-called duality revolution started, the only idea we had about string theory was in terms of the perturbative expansion. So you have this, perhaps you might have seen physicists drawing this type of pictures where string theory is supposed to be summed over surfaces. But this is by no means a definition. First of all, we know the theory is not typically convergent or not even summable, even for small but finite value of G. And so it's not even clear whether this is whether the theory exists. And so this is a potentially dangerous situation, because if the theory does not exist consistently, then you can make any statement you like out of it. So string theories had for 15 years this existential crisis. And actually there are examples of theory where we had reasonably consistent perturbative expansion, but actually turned out the theory does not exist. For example, QED, quantum electrodynamics, does not exist. It exists only as an effective theory of something else which is consistent. And on the other hand, QCD does exist, at least many field theories believe that. So even given the perturbative expansion, it's not clear whether the theory exists or not. And so the right-hand side of this correspondence, in a case when conformal field theory does exist, gives you a definition of the left-hand side. Yeah, so it depends on whether anti-Doppler space is Euclidean signature or Lorentzian signature. So Euclidean case is, of course, the thing you know very well that is a hyperbolic space. And then there is a Lorentzian version of that. So I will tell you about this later. For, depending on the choice of M, you have various different conformalities too. And the symmetry, if M has isometry, that is reflected to conformality theory as some kind of global symmetry. It will also realize in an idea that physicists had about the gauge theory, that it is believed that if you have gauge theory of, say, a gauge group SUN, if you take N to be large, the, it has been conjectured that the theory is, in some sense, a string theory. And this gives you a very explicit realization of this idea when conformal field theory is some kind of gauge theory with large N. There has also been a speculation on this side that quantum gravity is holographic, and I will tell you precisely what it means. And this is supposed to realize this idea also. And also, interestingly, I'm not sure, I wasn't at Joe Polsinski's lecture yesterday, but probably he mentioned towards the end how such correspondence comes out. Or did he? Okay. Many of you are not convinced that something like that can be true. And in fact, I have to say, with due respect to Joe, that derivation, and Juan Maldacena also, that the derivation hasn't, there hasn't been rigorous derivation of the correspondence. And in a sense, that it hasn't been shown that this is consistent, this correspondence is consistent with everything that one could in principle know about string theory in ADS, or anything that one could in principle know about conformal field theory. So the check has been made about things we can know in the current technology, but to the extent that theories are defined on both sides, there are in principle many other things that one could know. And that means that there are many falsifiable predictions that one could make and could, in principle, be checked in future. So those are also interesting. So that's the interest motivation for my... Hi, yes, please. No, I will give you precisely what the correspondence means later. Sure. Yeah, that's interesting. Theory of gravity is supposed to be diffeomorphism invariant, but we can, if the theory of gravity is defined in non-compact space, we can fix a boundary condition because we do fluctuate the geometry, but we can, if the space is non-compact, we can separate the normalizable fluctuation of the geometry and non-normalizable fluctuation of the geometry. For example, we can reasonably consider quantum gravity in a fixed, asymptotically flat Minkowskian background. And the theory does have, for example, notion of well-defined notion of energy and angular momentum, etc. And those are very well-defined concepts. And in isolated space is also non-compact space. So there is a notion of normalizable fluctuation of geometry and non-normalizable fluctuation of geometry. Normalizable fluctuation of geometry is the thing that you are supposed to quantize. And you are supposed to fix the non-normalizable fluctuation. So for each fixed asymptotic boundary condition, you have a quantum gravity. So it does make sense to say, consider quantum gravity in asymptotically unsuited. That, this is what I meant. So string theory in asymptotically unsuited space. So you can fluctuate geometry inside of the unsuited space, and they do. And in many cases, you can have, in certain situations, you can have lots of asymptotically unsuited space with interior having even different topologies. And you have to sum over them. And actually, there has been a very interesting question in quantum gravity of whether we are really supposed to sum over topologies or not. And since we have this correspondence, you can in principle ask what happens on this side if you do or do not sum over topologies. And the reasonable expectation about the behavior of conformal field theory seems to suggest that you do have to sum over topologies. For example, some of you who are at Robert Digraph's talk this week must have seen that he was summing over various different geometries with given boundary, but that was required by computing elliptic genus, which is a concept in conformality theory. So you do have to sum over geometry in order to get agreement with conformality theory. That's something that conformality theory teaches us about the behavior of quantum gravity. So today, I would like to, so the plan of my lecture, which may change, is that today, I will not talk about the correspondence yet, but there are several things that I need to tell you before even defining what the correspondence is about. So I will tell you about the basics of conformal field theory in various dimensions. Some of you may be familiar with two-dimensional conformal field theory, but there are concepts of that which can be extendable to higher dimensions. And then I will tell you about the basics of ADS T plus 2. I do not know what I can expect you to know. Dave Morrison told me that mathematicians, of course, knows very much about Euclidean anti-vector space, which is a hyperbolic space, but may not be too familiar with Lorentzian case, so I'll have to tell you something about that. And then tomorrow, I will state the correspondence. And then I'll give you some simple observations. Some of the evidences and some of the things that we may learn about conformal field theory and quantum gravity. And the original paper of the correspondence appeared, I think, 2 years ago, and it's here. There are some of the preceding works that anticipated this work, but this was summarized in this work. And then, recently, we wrote some review articles, so some of you want to know more about this, can take a look at it. Also, I do not particularly recommend you to print it out while you are at ITP. So, let me start with the basics of T plus one-dimensional conformal field theory. So let me briefly tell you about the Euclidean case. By that, I mean considering conformal field theory, Euclidean conformal field theory in flat T plus one dimensional space. And so I just write the metric in the radial coordinate to set the notation. So often I use this symbol to denote a metric on unit P sphere. Now, it is known that you can add point at infinity to make this space to sphere, and so this is some of the things that I'm going to do often. So, the reason the physicists can think that this is justifiable procedure in physical theory is that you can actually conformally compactify this space. By that I mean that if you change the radial coordinate into theta in this way, then the metric is conformally equivalent to that of the sphere. So this metric is nothing but the metric of the unit P plus one dimensional sphere times some conformal factor. So if you are considering conformal field theory, which by that I mean that the theory is independent of the conformal factor in front of the metric, you don't know whether the theory is here or here, so it is justifiable to add a point at infinity and conformally compactify the space. So, historically, you have sphere with north pole and south pole in this coordinate. You are adding the south pole at theta equal pi here. So, there are two observations I want to make about this space. The first thing, which is relevant for our discussion here later, is that T plus one-dimensional sphere is the boundary of P plus two-dimensional hyperbolic space. For P plus one dimension, which we may call as Euclidean. Actually, I don't like this way of saying it, because, of course, hyperbolic space preceded isoid space, but from the, from physicist's perspective, there was isoid space, and then you weak rotate to make hyperbolic space. So this hyperbolic space, as you know, in the Poincaré disk model, is just interior of disk, and so here you have P plus one dimensional disk, and the geodesic is just a circular arc which intersects with the boundary at the right angle. So you can regard, you can conformally compactify the hyperbolic space inside of the disk, and the boundary is one-dimensional row of sphere. So there is a correspondence between inside and the boundary, and that actually will become relevant in discussing ADS-GFC correspondence. And the other thing that is important of the conformality theory on sphere is the symmetry of the system. And you have conformal symmetry. And by that I mean a diffeomorphism, which preserves the metric up to the conformal multiplication. So there are many obvious conformal invariants. For example, you can rotate the sphere, and that's obviously a symmetry. So there is SOP plus 2 symmetry, which is a path of the conformal symmetry. And then there is a dilatation that if you pick any point here, you can scale the metric from this point, and then that will be a conformal symmetry. And there are So that is called dilatation. And then actually, there are P plus 2 generators of this type because on the P plus 1 dimensional sphere, there are, if you consider dilatation on this point, you can rotate the sphere to generate P plus 1 and P plus 2 independent generators of this type. And then they combine to make SOP plus 2, comma 1 group, and that is a conformal group of the sphere. And this acts on this naturally acts on the P plus 3 dimensional space with signature minus plus plus plus. Oh, excuse me. Actually, I use different notation. So plus, 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 and minus. And I use index for later convenience so that the first one starts from 0 tilde. Excuse me for the notation. And then 1, 2, all the way to P plus 1. And the last index is P plus 2. The reason I put tilde is that I'm going to need 0 for after weak rotation. Okay, so on the sphere there is a conformal symmetry of SOP plus 2. Comma 1, and then as I said, you have plus 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 minus 1. So there are those indices, and then among them you have P mu nu equals, so among these generators you have J mu nu, with mu and nu goes from 0 tilde to P plus 1, which generate SO P plus 2. I'm confusing group and algebra. And then there are generators of this type, which causes the dilatation. From given point, you can rescale the metric, rescale the coordinate. In conformal field theory, there is an important concept of conformal field. This is an operator of the theory which behaves naturally under rescaling. And so in particular, if you have a conformal field which is diagonalizing the dilatation around the origin, then under rescale of the coordinate, the conformal field phi behaves in this way. And this delta, this index delta is often called conformal dimension. Then here comes something which is a bit confusing often, and is important to clarify. And that is that, so this is generated by this dilatation generator d hat. So if you have a state corresponding to this operator, you see that this conformal field d hat gives you an eigenstate of the dilatation whose eigenvalue is pure imaginary, because as far as this delta is real, then the eigenvalue of the dilatation is pure imaginary. And so that means that conformal field theory on Euclidean sphere does not give you a unitary representation of SO p plus 1, p plus 2, comma 1, but actually it's non-unitary representation. Not the eigenvalue of unitary operator has to be real, but it is giving you a pure imaginary. And this often happens in Euclidean conformal field theory. Unitarity is to be imposed on field theory in Lorentzian signature space, and then the appropriate concept of unitarity actually it is formulated in terms of reflection positivity, etc., in Euclidean signature space, is to be derived from the unitarity of the Lorentzian signature case, and we'll see later that appropriate unitarity of the theory in Lorentzian signature space requires that d hat indeed has pure imaginary eigenvalue. And this will become important later. So anyway, so that's about conformal field theory on Euclidean space. Any question? Oh, yeah. I didn't explain very well. What I meant was the following: that you, of course, what I really meant was that you are to compute correlation functions. These operators sandwiched between vacuum state, which is to be annihilated by this dilatation operator. The vacuum is supposed to be invariant under dilatation. And then, typically what physicists does is to use some kind of so-called world identity, which is a trivial identity you can derive by saying that commutator of d hat with operator, if d hat annihilates the vacuum, should be equal to zero. And then, what I meant by this equation is that d and phi of x obeys a commutation relation such that this is equal to x del del x plus or minus, I forgot, plus delta of phi of x. This is a local version of this equation. And then, so therefore, combining this and this, you can see that this correlation function obeys the differential equation. Of this type. And this is some kind of simplified version of this statement. But what it really means is certain behavior, the fact that correlation functions obey certain differential equations derived from the conformal symmetry. So now we have seen the Euclidean case, so let me go to the Lorentzian case. So, in Lorentzian case, is obtained by weak rotating the Euclidean case. So, for example, if you have, so previously we had conformal symmetry of SOP plus 2, comma 1, acting on the space of this signature. As we'll see, the weak rotation changes this index to pure imaginary, sending this to minus plus 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 and then minus at the end, giving you SO P plus 1, comma 2. And correspondingly, the metric is also changed. The actual metric of the space is also changed. So let me first start with the Minkowski space metric. So you have the one-time direction and the p-flat direction written in the radial coordinate. In the case of flat space, sorry, Euclidean space, we just had one-point compactification. And that, I think, is familiar to all of you, that if you have flat Euclidean space, you can add infinity and then make sphere. I guess it is less known how to do the same thing in Lorentzian case, and so let me just do it now. So the idea is to do the conformal rescaling again, but now we have to actually use the light cone of the make use of the light cone of the flat space. So previously I erased the equation, but changed the radial coordinate into some tangent. But instead here I changed the two light cone direction made out of time and radial direction into different coordinates. But the outcome turns out to be something like that. So up to this conformal factor, we have the metric which takes up this form. And this metric you may recognize is a metric of the unit p-sphere. So, upon conformal rescaling, the metric of the flat Lorentzian signature space turns into metric on p-dimensional sphere times the time direction. But actually, the image of the conformal image of the flat Minkowski space is not the entire cylinder, but it's just a part of it. And what happens is that, so if I just consider the section in tau and theta direction, then you can see that, so this is pi and this is zero in theta direction, then the image of the Minkowski space is just this wedge. Actual space has p minus 1 sphere piece to it. But so this is the image of the Minkowski space, where this line corresponds to t plus r to be plus infinity, and this corresponds to t minus r to be minus infinity. Okay. You can just follow the change of the coordinate, so I don't explain detail. And so the conformal field theory in Minkowski space is defined on this way. But what one can show, actually rather rigorously using the axiomatic quantum field theory technique, is that if you consider T-ordered correlation function, in evaluating correlation function in Lorentzian signature space, you have to specify how to order the operator, and there is a canonical one which is called T-ordering, that order the operator according to the time ordering. And if you consider such correlation function, one can show that if you have reasonable conformal field theory, then correlation function of this type can be analytically extended to the entire cylinder. So therefore, it is quite natural, because conformal field theory should not know about this conformal factor, so it shouldn't know that it is just reading inside of the wedge. So it is natural to consider, therefore, conformal field theory on the cylinder. But actually, this conformal symmetry of the flat space knows about both aspects, both of these two aspects of the geometry, and that we can see in the following way. So, like I said, there is the SOP plus 1, comma 2 is acting on the space of this signature. But depending on how you decompose this space, you can have two different interesting decompositions of this group S of P plus 1, 2 into subgroups. And one is to consider this Euclidean path, group Euclidean path only, and obtain S of P plus 1. And then you just look at the other complementary path and find SO2 symmetry. So this is a natural subgroup of this. And this corresponds to rotation of SP, which is this path, and time translation. Namely, Hamiltonian. On three-dimensional sphere. So this decomposition naturally corresponds to the identification of space after conformal compactification. On the other hand, you can also decompose this into SO P plus 1, a P comma 1, times SO 1 comma 1. Now, instead of grouping this and this together, we can look at the first P plus 1 of them to make this subgroup, and then look at the last two to identify the SO 1 1. This decomposition naturally corresponds to the original Minkowski space geometry, because this is nothing but the Lorentz group of the P dimension, whereas this is a dilatation. So depending on how you decompose this group, you have the remnants of both of these geometries. This just to set up notation for my definition of ADS-CST correspondence tomorrow, so that I can tell you a little bit more about ADS-CST correspondence than just verbally saying that there are correspondence between these two theories. So, as before, in the case of Euclidean space, there are various generators of SOP plus 1, 2. And in the notation over there, for example, SO 1, 1 is generated by JP plus 1, P plus 2, and this is to be identified with the dilatation. And one can also see that this combination of the this part of the generator can be written in this way. In the notation of the flat Minkowski space, where P mu is translation or momentum, on the Minkowski space, whereas K mu is a generator of special conformal transformation. By that I mean, by translation, I mean if I use X mu as a standard flat Minkowski space coordinate, then translation is simply this generator, whereas special conformal transformation is generated in this way with infinitesimal vector epsilon. Also a generator of the conformal symmetry of the flat space. So by combining momentum and special conformal transformation, you can also give you other generators of the S of P plus 1, comma 2. Now, one of the important things that about aspects of the conformal field theory in Lorentzian space is that this theory has, in principle, two types of Hamiltonian, two different Hamiltonians that one can define. So this is the original metric of the flat Lorentzian signature space. So you have this time variable t. This system, this coordinate has isometry in tau direction. So there is a corresponding Hamiltonian to it. But after conformal rescaling, the resulting space here is also symmetric under tau translation. But these two coordinates are obviously different. So therefore, the corresponding generators are different. But you can follow the change of the coordinates to see the relation of the two. And in fact, so as it, by definition here, P0 is a Hamiltonian on this space, whereas H, which I define to be this component of the generator, is the Hamiltonian on the cylinder picture. Because, well, this is what I said over here, that this generator J0P plus 2 corresponds to this SO2 subgroup of SOP plus 1, comma 2. And this generator, I have already explained, corresponds to tau translation. So, this is to be identified with the Hamiltonian on R times SP. And I have shown here, I didn't show, but I wrote here, that this corresponds to the combination of K0 plus P0. And so this is a Hamiltonian on R times SP. So we see clearly that those are different. And the spectrum of these Hamiltonians are very different. This spectrum of this Hamiltonian is continuous and no gap. By that I mean that you have the vacuum and then you have a continuous spectrum starting from vacuum. And this is as it should be because in Minkowski space there is no natural scale in the theory and we are looking at conformal field theory. So there is no way that you can have gap because if you have gap then it means that the theory contains some characteristic scale of length or the energy and so for conformal field theory it's impossible. So we clearly know that spectrum of this is continuous. On the other hand, the spectrum of this can be, and indeed is in the cases we know, is discrete. At least a part of that is discrete, and it has gap. And the reason is that this theory have, in this way of presenting it, we have a natural scale to our problem, which is the radius of the sphere. So the theory can have discrete, the spectrum of H can have discreteness whose scale is set by the size of the sphere. And so when we talk about the reason that I have been bombarding you with all these generators, etc., is that when we compare the Hilbert space of conformal field theory here and the swing theory in isolated space, it is useful to decompose the Hilbert spaces of both sides into representation of this symmetry. We will see that theory in isolated space also have this symmetry. So it's natural that Hilbert space is decomposed into irreducible representation of this symmetry, algebra. And actually, it is more useful to look at the spectrum of this rather than this because deciphering continuous spectrum is very difficult, while it's easy to identify states with this discrete spectrum. Yes. That's right, exactly. Yeah, so in just to tell you the correspondence in two-dimensional CFT, L minus 1 is a generator of the flat space. This is to be identified with del dv in the typical notation, whereas L0 is dvd plus h or something. And this naturally corresponds to L0 rather than L minus 1. This has continuous spectrum, whereas this can have discrete spectrum. And indeed, in analyzing spectrum of two-dimensional conformal field theory, we always use this one. For example, character of the Virasoro algebra, etc., look at the spectrum L0 rather than L minus. Well, so I have told you about Lorentzian conformal field theory and Euclidean conformal field theory, but these are really the two aspects of the same theory, that they are related to each other by weak rotation, namely transforming the time variable into pure imaginary. And this is a justifiable procedure as far as we know that Hamiltonian has positive definite spectrum, because the weak rotation works in such a way that in Lorentzian signature case, we have the Hamiltonian generator like that. And what we do is write T is equal to I tau. So if you do that, then this becomes minus H tau. And as far as H has spectrum bounded below, this is a very well-defined operator, because as energy increases, this is just suppressed exponentially as far as tau is positive. So as far as we have a theory with bounded spectrum, the weak rotation makes sense. Now, I would like to use the weak rotation to tie the representation of SOP plus 1, 2 and SOP plus 2, 1. Of course, we cannot do it if you require both representations to be unitary, so we have to sacrifice the unitarity of one of them, and we sacrifice the unitarity of the Euclidean case. So, like I said, SOP plus 2, 1 and SOP plus 1, 2 is related by the relation that O tilde, the first component, is related to minus I of O. And so both of them, these are supposed to be represented on the same Hilbert space, because we are looking at the same quantum field theory, just weak rotation. Weak rotation does not change the Hilbert space. It just changes the way that operators are acting. And we are considering unitary representation of this group. And so it is non-unitary for this group. And suppose we have a state, which is an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian has discrete spectrum, so the corresponding eigenstate is normalizable, which is another nice aspect of looking at this Hamiltonian rather than the one up T0, because that would have continuous spectrum, so the corresponding states are not normalizable. It's delta function normalizable at best. So eigenstate. So if you have an eigenstate of this, then you can follow your nose and see what kind of state that you are getting with respect to this algebra. And then you can easily see that this gives an eigenstate of B hat. I guess, unless you are taking notes, you might have forgotten what B hat is. B hat is a dilatation in the Euclidean case to be distinguished from D. So I intentionally distinguished D and D hat. D is the dilatation in Lorentzian case, and D hat is the dilatation in Euclidean case. And you can see, by looking at the correspondence of the operator assignment, you can see that if you have an eigenstate of this operator in Lorentzian case, then you have an eigenstate of D hat in Euclidean case with eigenvalue minus I epsilon. So indeed you have this group non-unitarily realized. Now this fits nicely with what we saw earlier about the conformal field in Euclidean theory. Namely, if you have a conformal field in Euclidean theory, then I said that this have a nice commutation relation with d hat. Yeah, I guess I should have started saying this in this way, with commutation relation given by this. So therefore, if you have a vacuum annihilated by d, by acting x on the vacuum and setting x equal to 0, you can see that d hat acting on this upon commuting with this one, annihilating this one, gives you an eigenstate of d hat with eigenvalues minus I delta. I guess I should have put I here. So this is nice because that means that if you have an operator of eigenvalue the conformal dimension delta, by acting that operator on the vacuum, we can create an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian in the Lorentzian case. And this is the so-called state operator correspondence in conformal field theory. Have an operator of conformal dimension delta, you can create a state of which is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. This is well known in the case of two-dimensional conformal field theory, but this is, as I showed here, that this is true also in higher dimension. I only showed in one direction that if you had an operator, then you can create a state. There is a physicist way of explaining why the converse is true, but in a short notice, I haven't figured out how to do it in a way that is, if Graham Segal is here, perhaps he could explain to all of you, but I'm not prepared to do that. But I think that the converse is also true, that if you have a state, then you can somehow glue, you can somehow cut out a part of the space, glue the operator, the state over there to define the operator. And there is a question of whether, in some cases, there is no state, which has a bit subtle to see whether you can really do it locally or not. But in many of the operators that I'm going to talk about tomorrow, that the correspondence can be just established. So this is what is called state operator correspondence in conformal field theory. So. If you have conformal field theory in P plus one dimension, therefore, you have a unitary representation of SO P plus one, comma two. And so the Hilbert space of the theory is to be decomposed into some of irreducible representation of SO P plus one, comma two. And there are many interesting, important facts about the unitary representation of this group that is useful, and we can learn lots about conformal field theory from that. For example, there is so-called unitarity constraint, that representation of S of P plus 1, comma 2 is characterized by a pair of highest weights. One is an eigenstate of SO2, which is the energy, and the other is the representation of S of P plus 1, which we may call a spin of the state. And so there is a unitarity constraint. In order to have a unitary representation of SOP plus 1, comma 2, you cannot have an arbitrary eigenstate of epsilon and spin. And for example, the energy has to be greater than minus a half P minus 1 if we are looking at a scalar state. That is the spin zero representation or trivial representation of SOP plus 1. Or if you are looking at the spinner, then eigen's value has to be greater than half p. And if you are looking at the vector, it has to be greater than p, etc. Where p plus 1 is the dimension of the space-time that we began with. And you perhaps can figure out that in the case of free field, free conformal field theory, the equality is saturated. So these are some of the things that is useful to know about conformal field theory. So that's all about conformal field theory, and I guess I have 20 more minutes to finish dance with the space. But before that, if there is any question. So that is the question of whether you can have a notion of S matrix in conformal field theory. And S matrix, in order to define S matrix, you have to use the flat Minkowski metric rather than the cylinder metric, because you want to have asymptotic flat regions to send particles in and out. But the problem is that, as I have argued, that in the flat Minkowski picture, the Hamiltonian is P naught rather than P naught plus K naught, which has gas. P naught has continuous spectrum. So, therefore, in particular, you cannot distinguish vacuum at the end point of the continuous spectrum. So, that's what we mean by we don't have particle picture. If you have a particle mass M, then the spectrum starts with some gap, and then there will be a continuous spectrum of particles. But you don't have that gap here. So that makes it difficult to define a well-defined notion of asymptotic particle state. And so that's why we don't have well-defined S matrix in the case of conformal field theory. Okay, now that I have finished the various properties of conformal field theory in both Euclidean and Lorentzian signature case, so let me now go over to the basic of unsignature space. So that we can talk about the correspondence of the two tomorrow. The Euclidean case is a thing that you know very well from the beginning of the last century. And so I won't talk very much about it. This is just a hyperbolic space. So as Poincaré said, that you can realize that inside of the sphere disk, and this is the Poincaré disk model, that geodesics is a circular arc which intersects with the boundary at the right angle. But physicists have to use coordinates, and coordinate, I guess, is something you are not familiar with too much. So I have to tell you something about that. So. So hyperbolic space in p plus 1 dimensions is given by this parabola. With this metric. So this naturally has an isometry of SO p plus 2 comma 1, which is, by the way, coinciding with the conformal symmetry of the Euclidean space. And here you have the caricature of this space. So we have this kind of hyperbole. And although this space has indefinite signature, but since this is everywhere space-like, so the resulting induced metric on it is Euclidean. So I have to introduce coordinates to start the story. So actually, I have to use two sets of coordinates, which gives the solution to this equation. And one set of the coordinates starts with 1 over cosine rho, and then I write x1 to be tangent rho times e1, all the way to tangent rho EP plus 1 and P plus 1, P plus 2 is tangent rho of EP plus 2, where this E is such that E square is equal to 1, namely E is a coordinate of P plus 1 dimensional sphere. And you can show that this obeys this by using 1 over cosine square minus tangent square is equal to 1. okay. We can also, excuse me, but I have to do it. And there is another useful coordinate, and I have to use both of them, unfortunately, is to write this multiplied by cosine hyperbolic tau. And then this is tangent rho E1 tilde all the way up until here is the same, but the last one is 1 over cosine rho sine hyperbolic tau. And one can, once again, we can show that this is disobeys this by using this and cos square minus sinh square is equal to 1. And but now this E tilde is a coordinate of SP rather than SP plus 1. So there are two different ways of solving this equation, which covers entire hyperbolic space in either case. And in the first set of coordinates, we can rewrite this metric as 1 over cosine square rho d rho square plus sine square rho d omega t plus 1. But rho goes from 0 now to pi over 2. So we see that this is nothing a metric on the disk, and this is the Poincaré model. So we have rho equal 0 here, and then rho equal pi over 2 here. And the boundary of this space is SP plus 1, which I mentioned earlier is related to the Euclideanized, conformally compactified Euclidean P plus 1 dimensional sphere. But the metric diverges near the boundary, so this space in fact is non-compact. In this set of coordinates, the metric can be written as ds square is cosine square rho d tau square plus d rho square plus sine square rho d omega t. So now we see that this part of the metric is P plus one dimensional hyperbolic space, but we have additional translation. And this is coordinatizing this space in a slightly different way. And so on one of the boundary points, you have tau equal minus infinity, and the other boundary point, you have tau equal plus infinity, and the tau constant surface goes in this way. So it's a sequence of surfaces like that. And so start from this and then evolve and then come back to the other point. And rho constant surface basically goes in this way, like the trademark of Panamericans. So and then each of these tau constant surface, each of the tau constant surface is one-dimensional lower hyperbolic space. Hyperbolic space of one-dimensional lower. So in the case of p-dimensional sphere, we know that p-dimensional sphere can be considered as the family of p minus one-dimensional sphere, etc. So you have this Matryoshka structure, and you have a similar thing for hyperbolic space. But I think I should stop embarrassing myself telling you about the Euclidean case. So let me go to let me do the weak rotation and go to the Lorentzian signature case. As I said earlier, if you have a quantum field theory in Lorentzian signature space, and if the Hamiltonian is positive definite, we can always do the weak rotation to Euclidean space. And we can do the converse also. And so if you have a Hamiltonian, we can weak rotate. So the reason that I introduced this rather type of metric is that in this way you can see that the space has isometry in tau translation. So there is a corresponding operator if you have a quantum field theory on it, and then we can weak rotate. So we can weak rotate. Tau goes to minus I tau and obtain this metric. So this is the Lorentzian version of hyperbolic space, which is called anti-vector space. Well, so the purpose of my writing this was to see how this changes the coordinate variable. Well, the only place tau, we have tau is here and here, and tau goes to I tau does not keep this to be real, whereas this becomes pure imaginary. So the only thing that you do by doing the weak rotation is changing xp plus 2 to be I xp plus 2. So therefore, these two equations that characterize the anti-vector space is modified accordingly so that we have x0 square minus x1 square minus dot 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 xp plus 1 square plus xp plus 2 square is equal to 1, and dx square is minus dx0 square plus dx1 square plus dot 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 plus dxp plus 1 square minus dp plus 2 square. And the corresponding parameterization is just given by the weak rotation of this. And so what you have is, once again, p plus 3 dimensional space. You have x0, xp plus 2, and then x1 to xp plus 1. But now you see that this space has two times. So we have two time directions and p plus 1 dimensional spatial directions. The space, the solution to this equation is another type of hyperboloid of this type. But now, although there are two times, but it is winding around only once in this direction, so the induced metric has one time and p plus 1 dimensional state. And so this space has closed time-like curve, but of course we don't like closed time-like curve. That will break causality. And so what we do is to consider universal covering of this space, and that's what we have in mind with the metric. So there was a Dujita space. Originally, Dujita, after, so the history goes that Einstein tried to find a solution to his equation to describe the universe. And he found that if you have matter in it, then you cannot have a stationary space. And so in order to balance that, he introduced the so-called cosmological constant to keep, to find a stationary solution. And that the resulting solution is called Einstein static universe. And I think that has positive cosmological constant to balance the presence of the matter. And then Dujita found, to the dismay of Einstein, that this Einstein equation with cosmological constant itself has a solution which is not stationary. And that has positive cosmological constant, and that solution is called Dujita solution, which describes the expanding universe. And it is used, for example, to describe the so-called inflationary error of the early universe. So that has positive cosmological constant, namely that in the Euclidean version, it has positive scalar curvature. So it's maximally symmetric space with positive scalar curvature. And this is the, in Euclidean version of this, at least has negative scalar curvature, so that's anti-Dujita space. So this space, as you can see, has disk. So I said earlier that for each fixed tau, we have p plus one dimensional hyperbolic space, which is a disk, and then we just weak rotate the time variable, so it doesn't change the fact that spatial section is still a disk, a Poincaré disk. So the global geometry of the resulting anti-vector space is that the spatial section is a Poincaré disk of p plus one dimension, and then we have time direction. And so therefore, after conformal compactification, the boundary of space is R times SP. And that is again important because R times SP is a conformal compactification of conformally compactified Minkowski space can be embedded into R times SP. And of course, the Antioch space itself is infinite. That what the diagram I draw over there is conformally equivalent to Antioch space. And as you know, that causal structure of space-time is not modified by conformal rescaling because the light ray travels in the equation where ds squared equals zero. So that equation is independent of the conformal rescaling. So this depicts the causal structure, and in particular, this space has time-like boundaries. So in order to define the theory, you have to impose the boundary condition at infinity, which, as we will see tomorrow, is translated into some data of the field theory on the boundary. And this theory has isometry of S O P, P plus 1, 2, as we can see from this equation. And this has subgroup of S O P plus 1, S O 2. And this corresponds to rotation of the boundary, and this corresponds to tau translation, as similarly to what we saw in the case of conformal fusion. Now, in the remaining 5 minutes, I have to tell you about some aspects of classical fusion theory in Antioch space. So, I'm gonna do the string theory in Antioch space tomorrow, but in the limit when the tension of string is strong, string theory reduces to field theory, and in the limit when we can ignore the string coupling constant, we are essentially looking at free field in Antioch space. So free field in Antioch space is a limit of string theory in Antioch space, so this is something we first have to understand in order to do anything else. So, we have this metric, and actually, I have to introduce some parameter for the purpose of discussion tomorrow. So far, I didn't introduce any of the parameter of the scale of length, but in physics, the dimension is important, and so R is just a constant which gives you the curvature radius. Over into the space. Now, so we have to consider free fields in Antioch space. For example, if you have a scalar field, it obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. And we want to understand the solution to this kind of equation. Well, so if you have a scalar field, for example, then we are only interested in scalar field which is square integrable in Antioch space, because such term appears in the action of the scalar field. So if it is infinite, then it's infinitely suppressed. So what we have to do is just harmonic analysis. Of square integral function on Antioch space, and we know that that can be expressed as sum of unitary representation of S of P plus 1. So each of these are irreducible unitary representation of S of P plus 1, 2. And this is something that has been very well studied. And in particular, the equation motion that I wrote here has a very natural interpretation in terms of unitary representation, because this is nothing, this Laplace operator is nothing but the Casimir operator of SO 3,2, P plus 2,2. So this is scalar field with given mass has fixed Casimir. Actually, the nice thing about Antioch space compared to, say, flat space is that for each given mass, for each given cosmere, the, all the solution, normalizable solution to this equation, is given, belong to the single irreducible representation of SO P plus 1, 2. The luxury that we don't have in flat space. So, so therefore, we can write the solution to this equation. So you have tau rho and omega p in this way. So you decompose SO p plus 2, 2 into SO p plus 2 times SO2. So in order to build the irreducible representation, we first consider ellipse of each of these. And but this is given by the spherical harmonics. And this is abelian. So this is an eigenstate of that. Yes. No, unless omega is integral. I'm not saying, well, oh, excuse me, so it's an ellipse of universal covering of this group.
Yeah, but that's
square. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. So it's square integrable, how can I say it? For, yeah, for given, so, yeah, yeah, actually, this is, there is some subtlety in what I said. So this, each of these solutions is actually the norm of each solution is independent of tau. So there is an infinity coming from the tau integral. But modulo that is square integral. Well, so I guess it depends on whether omega is rational or irrational. I guess we consider perhaps, so we do this, yeah, actually, I'm sorry, I apologize. So we consider this for each rational omega and take the limit where omega becomes zero. Yeah, really, I guess this condition has to be imposed on the, yeah, no, I shouldn't try to improvise. I just have to apologize. And so you just consider, I think, that n is covering and then take the limit when n is infinity. Excuse me. So anyway, this is all controlled by representation theory of SOP plus comma. So it's very simple. And in particular, we can show, we know about the spectrum omega. And so we can find, so G is given by hypergeometric function. Actually, somebody told me that hyper of hypergeometric function is related to hyper of hyperbolic space, but I'm not sure whether it's true or not, that somebody knows about it. Anyway, so omega is given by 1 over r, which is the scale that I set over here. If you don't like r, you can just bring it to over here and redefine. Is given by lambda plus minus plus L plus 2n, where L is the orbital angular momentum of the spherical harmonics. So the cosmere is L plus, I forgot, P or something. And n is integer. And lambda plus minus is given by related to the dimension of the space-time. So actually, my time is running out, so I should perhaps stop here. So, I just wanted to say that this kind of equation can be easily solved by just appealing to the representation theory. And so you have this choice, but these choices are determined by boundary condition for scalar field. For given boundary condition, there are Neumann-type boundary condition, Dirichlet-type boundary condition that you can impose for the scalar field. And depending on that, you choose one of these two branches. You have to have this to be real, so that requires the mass square to be greater than a quarter of minus p plus 1 square. And that is known as Brighton-Rona-Friedman bound. And it's interesting that in Young-Schlitter space, tachyon is allowed to a certain extent, that m square can be negative, but to a certain extent. And so that's all I have to tell you for today. And with this preparation, I hope I can define what ABS CFT correspondence means. And tomorrow I will also try to tell you some simple observations about that. That's it.